Now, Google, the company that revolutionized the way we search the internet, plans to make some of the world's most famous academic libraries available online. Google announced today that it will allow web browsers to search millions of library books online and read all or a portion of them on their computer screen. Declan McCullough writes about the tech industry for CNET at news.com. He joins us on the line from his Washington, D.C. office. And Declan, tell us, which libraries, first of all, are we talking about?
We're talking about some pretty big libraries. The University of Michigan, Stanford University, Oxford University, and a much smaller number, something like 40,000 volumes from Harvard University.
And how are they going to do this? What is this process like?
They haven't released the details yet, but if you think about it, they can't pay humans to do it. It's just simply too expensive. We're talking about tens of millions of books. The only way you can digitize all this information is to not have a human type it in, but to scan it in with a computer and then try to have the computer translate those scanned images into text. Google says that it has invented some new technology that will drastically speed up the process. But you got to figure at least a few dollars a book, so I'm just speculating a few hundred million dollars.
Wow. And why? Why would Google do this?
Well, one of the things it's done very, very well is indexed the Internet, the public World Wide Web. And so once it's done with that, a company, any company, has to grow. Google's growth path seems to be finding offline text, both physical and virtual, and bringing it online. It recently announced Google Scholar, which is bringing academic text online, and now it's going after libraries.
Is this perhaps a way to stay a step ahead of other search engines?
Definitely. What Google has done is created this massive distributed computer, probably the largest one that's owned by any one company in the world. As of about 18 months ago, it was 10,000 servers. You got to figure after the cash infusion, it's a lot larger. And so now that they have this massive computer system, this really unprecedented one, they can turn this to new tasks relatively easily. And I think this is really their biggest competitive advantage over Microsoft and Yahoo. Because if Google indexes all this information from all these libraries, if Microsoft and Yahoo, if they want to compete, they're going to have to go back and do exactly the same thing. That's a lot of money, and Google is right now one step ahead of them.
Yeah. And we understand it could take up to 6 years to complete this project. And, you know, after the books are scanned, then they're going to be indexed word by word so that searchers can readily use them. What is that going to mean? Are people going to be reading books online from, let's say, Harvard University, or how's that going to work?
Actually, yes, they could. If you're, say, using the word book in your search query and some terms come up that are in that book, then you'll see that as part of your standard Google.com search. Depending on what kind of book you're looking at, if it's a book that's still under copyright, you'll just see an excerpt and maybe a page or two nearby so you get some context. But if the book is out of copyright, if it's sufficiently old, then you can see the entire book online.
So you could possibly type in, let's say, enemy of none but a common friend of all, and get the book of that same title, An International Perspective on the Lender of Last Resort Function by Curzio Giannini, which is in the Baker Library at Harvard.
Exactly right.
What then do you think this means for, you know, brick-and-mortar libraries? Is this going to have the same effect on, let's say, publishing and taking out a book as digitized music has on the music industry?
It could. I remember going to an American Library Association conference a few years ago. This is probably 4 or 5 years ago now, and they were already pretty worried about the future of brick-and-mortar libraries, as you said, when more and more people do search for information online. I don't think this is going to replace libraries or something to be said for browsing, but in the long run, libraries are going to have to find a way to remain useful.
What does it mean to me, the consumer? Does it mean anything to my pocketbook?
I don't think it means that much to the consumer that would buy a book. You can imagine someone who might buy some Mark Twain books. They can get those online now either through something like Project Gutenberg, which has existed for almost a decade, or something eventually like Google service. But you still might want to actually pick up the volume and read a book. It's still, at least for the foreseeable future, easier, and it's more pleasant to read a book in paper than on the screen. So I think it matters a lot for researchers and people and even consumers doing research, but I don't think it's going to damage the book industry, at least right away.
But for somebody who needs research and would travel to Cambridge, Massachusetts, or Cambridge, England, now they can just go online.
Absolutely. This is simply brilliant for them.
Thank you, Declan. Declan McCullough, reporter for CNET at news.com. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C. You've seen them everywhere, those magnetic yellow ribbons on the backs of cars with slogans such as "Pray for our troops." Well, one of the companies that's been selling the magnets has seen its sales nosedive and had to cut 40 people from its sales force. The problem? Factories in China are producing the magnets at a fraction of the price. We begin a look at China trade with Duane Gullion. He's founder of Magnet America. He joins us from Bennett, North Carolina. And Duane, I know that yours is a small family-owned business, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And the yellow ribbons in support of troops have been around, well, since the Iran hostage crisis. But how did you and when did you get the idea of producing them in support of the troops in Iraq?
Back in April of last year, a local screen printer came up with the idea. And I was just around and had done business with this company and found out about it and decided to try to market these, primarily just in our local area. But it seems to have taken off.
Oh, it really has taken off. I mean, tell me about, you know, some of your best-selling months, for instance.
The major sales came in this summer.
Yeah, give us some numbers.
We sold over 200,000 of the Support Our Troops in August.
Wow, I mean, that's a lot. And so who was buying these ribbons from you?
Primarily from the family readiness groups.
So these are families of the military.
That's right.
And as you know, it's just spread like wildfire. They're in turn selling them to other people, I'm sure. But your numbers fell off in November. Now, can you directly tie that to production in China?
Yes, that and the domestic printers that have imitated our idea. But primarily the imported product is the cheapest product, and it's coming in here so that the dollar stores and convenience stores can sell these things for anywhere from $1 to $2.
And how much do you sell them for?
We sell them, if you buy 25, they're 99 cents, and then you resell them from $2 to $5. A lot of the family readiness groups were able to sell these for $4 and $5.
Right, and we should say that part of your proceeds went to a charity.
Yes, we've donated $42,000 to Freedom Calls. It's a nonprofit foundation that has communication set up in Baghdad, north of Baghdad, so the military can stay in touch with their family.
Okay. So the factories in China are making these ribbons for about 70% less than you make them for, selling them, of course, for much less. But some would say, isn't that the way of the world of capitalism?
It is. It's a global competition. I mean, I understand that argument. The main problem is this is a design that was originated here by a local printer, and we are trying to protect our designs, but it's just the way the global economy works now. It's very easy for the offshore printers to come to see an idea and to run with it.
And rip it off. Let's
right.
let's be blunt. But you've been approached by a Chinese company that would manufacture these for you and do it for far less and make you money and everything would be fine, no?
Well, we just, our company believes that it's patriotic to produce this. It may not be very smart as far as business, but when it comes to patriotic product, we feel strongly that it should be manufactured, printed in the United States.
Did you know that $7.9 million worth of American flags in 2002 were imported, many of them from China?
That doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, and most imported flags do come from China, about $5 million worth last year. Many of them have 53 stars on them, which is a problem.
Oh, no.
But it's the way of the global world.
We understand, and we're a young company. We've been around now a year and a half, and we're finding out the ways of the world, but we're going to stick with patriotic product manufactured and printed in the U.S. and just take our lumps. And, you know, we may have to go have things imported at some point in time, but right now our plan is not to import any of our patriotic products.
I want to ask you a little bit about your company. As we know, companies in China pay very low wages. They are not unionized. How about your company? How many people do you employ? Do you offer health benefits? Are your workers unionized?
We're not unionized. We do offer health insurance, and it is just a lot more expensive to the labor costs here in America with the hourly wages and so forth.
But wouldn't you be able to keep more workers, let me think this through, and pay your workers better if you let the Chinese company manufacture these for less?
I think that's a good point. Possibly you could. I don't know that we would be able to hire more. I guess if your sales were to stay steady or increase because you were able to have a higher volume from lower costs.
Right, right.
But we've believed that there are ways that we can compete and stay in business by coming out with more ideas. You know, the ones that I think that China is going to, that the importers are going to continue to knock off are going to be the ones that are very popular, that have real high volume. But when it comes to something like a local high school or a local cause, someone, we've been approached by groups that want to do them for donors, you know, people that donate their organs, and people that would want to do one for spay and neuter your pets. I mean, you know, China's not going to knock that off. So if we can specialize in certain areas and work directly with the local groups, then we're going to be fine.
You're saying China is forcing you to be more enterprising.
That's right. Yep.
You know, there are some people who would say, given what old relations between China and the U.S. were during the Cold War,
right,
and the fear of China,
mm-hmm,
isn't this a good thing that China is sort of getting behind supporting the troops in a funny way?
I think it's enterprising on their part. I mean, they have one of the fastest growing economies, probably the fastest growing economy in the world. I was over there in July. We have two adopted daughters from China, and it's amazing that to see the changes in 2 years, how many more cars there are, and it's just a booming country. And you cannot blame the Chinese for, like you said, being very enterprising.
Dwayne, you have two daughters adopted from China.
Right.
So you're certainly not averse to, I don't mean to trade.
Right.
You know, and you've been to China.
Right. I love China. I love the Chinese people.
As a parent of two Chinese children, you're hardly going to vilify their homeland.
No. Mm-mm.
And just as a manufacturer, when you were in China, did you get a sense of this huge economic engine that's been just racing?
We were in we visited Guangzhou in southern China. It's one of the main areas for manufacturing. A lot of the factories are there, and then we were also in Shanghai, and I rode a bicycle around on a Sunday morning and saw HP and saw Cummins engine, diesel engines, and saw FedEx hub. It was just amazing to see all the different American companies that are represented in China.
Yeah. Dwayne Gullion, founder of Magnet America. They make some of those yellow magnets for the back of the car that support the troops in Iraq. Dwayne, thanks for speaking with us.
I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
And by the way, for more information on Dwayne's company, you can go to our website, here-now.org. And as Dwayne illustrated, U.S. relations with China can be complicated. Dwayne mentioned seeing all those U.S. companies in China. When we come back, convincing those companies that it's in their interest to pressure Chinese officials for better working conditions. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. It's here and now. We're talking, as everyone seems to be, about China. We spoke with a man in North Carolina who makes those ubiquitous yellow ribbon car magnets. He says a cheaper Chinese version has forced him to cut his labor force in half, but he also just told us that China was also forcing him to be more creative. And in fact, he admired China's enterprising spirit. Well, critics say that part of what makes China so competitive is substandard salaries and often appalling working conditions. An international conference on working conditions was planned for this week in Beijing. Many of the government, labor, and business leaders from 30 countries were expecting to attend when the Chinese government abruptly revoked their visas last Thursday and canceled the conference at the last minute. Inappropriate and inconvenient timing was the only official explanation. Joining us now from Paris is John Evans. He's Secretary General of the Trade Union Advisory Committee of the OECD. That's the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. They're sort of the middleman between unions and industrialized nations and other countries around the world. And the OECD was co-sponsoring that event with the Chinese government. John, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to have a chance to talk to you.
Well, what were you planning to do at this conference? Was it going to be adversarial? Were you going to demand to see sweatshops, for instance?
No, that certainly wasn't the objective. The purpose was to work with both representatives of the Chinese government and also some of the foreign investors who are in China at the moment, and begin to discuss how to apply, you know, international standards on good practice by investors on labor conditions, environment conditions, health and safety. So it was certainly designed to be a way of helping actually improve the conditions of Chinese workers and actually put a bit of a floor in the market internationally on labor standards. So we're pretty disappointed and annoyed that the meeting was canceled this way.
Well, I imagine. And just how bad are working conditions? Of course, we hear, you know, that they are bad, but how bad are they?
Well, I think the issue is the enormous gaps which exist both in levels of wages and now and incomes and in working conditions. You've got 400 million Chinese living in cities, 800, 900 million still living rurally, and there's something like 100 million of those rural workers actually, it's guessed, as acting as migrants, moving to the cities and working in poor conditions. And they're the ones who are really being exploited. You can see the problems of wages not being paid, even the minimum wages of $60 to $80 a month not being paid, something like 100,000 sort of individual disputes or strikes or reactions of one kind or another to injustices which are estimated to take place each year.
In fact, we understand that there are these mass incidents, as the Ministry of Public Security calls them. There's been a 15% rise over the year before. So these protests are on the rise. There are labor protesters who are being arrested. But I'm wondering, are you finding any sympathetic Chinese officials?
Yes, I mean, it's interesting. I think there are two discussions going on within China, within the authorities. There are those who are clearly worried about the social unrest. But at the same time, clearly there are people and high up in the Chinese authorities who are extremely nervous about anything that may be seen in the short term to cut the comparative advantage and the competitiveness advantage of China. So I think those two lines of thought are conflicting in the Chinese authorities, and they probably paid out, although it's only speculation, with regard to this seminar, which was due to take place this week.
Mm. Well, but you also said that you would hope to improve conditions by pressuring foreign investors. How do you do that? What's in it for them? I mean, China is such a huge economic engine right now. Why would a foreign investor back out?
Well, but they also have their brands to be concerned about. If you see the sourcing, which major brands in footwear, sports goods, textiles, clothing, actually the quantity of production that comes from China now, in those areas there are serious risks of health and safety, accidents, poor working conditions, then those companies themselves are at risk.
In fact, one CEO told you why it was important to him.
Yeah, one CEO told me that if a fire goes up in one of the dormitories where he has workers living at one of his plants, then it doesn't matter a damn if the law is applied or if the state-controlled unions are there. It's the company's image and brand which goes up in flames as well. And I think clearly there's a lot of nervousness among some companies about that now. And as companies go into other sectors, I mean, you can see the coal mining sector now, which is being opened up to foreign investors. China produces 30% of the world's coal, but has 80% of the world's fatalities of miners each year. And that's appalling, and I think many people in China realize that has to be improved.
Well, I'm thinking they have satellite dishes. They're watching news from around the world. They know.
You've got also the internet, and the tragedies over the last two or three weeks of the mining accidents, and the anger and the reaction to that, I think, is a sign that people do know. The question is, what are the solutions? And certainly one of the solutions that we feel is important is having effective representatives of workers, trade unions that are able to go in and check safety issues. And that's certainly what we're working towards to try to get established in the future.
What do you think about recent developments moving towards unionizing and presumably more rights? You mentioned government-controlled unions. Well, Walmart has agreed to have a weakened union, but a union nonetheless in a Walmart in China. I'm sure some of our listeners are saying Walmart doesn't even have a union here in the United States.
It can cut both ways. You know, if the only union that Walmart wants in the world is in China, maybe that says something about the unions in China. If it's a start of really trying to get some change to improve standards, because there was a lot of treatment in the Chinese press of how Walmart was actually driving down working conditions in China as well as elsewhere in the world, then maybe it's a start of something positive. these were issues we'd hoped to discuss this week in China with some of the investors, and Walmart had been invited to the seminar.
Really? You're saying the Chinese press saw Walmart as someone who would be importing bad labor practices into China?
Well, I heard that from Chinese, the official trade unions, who are concerned about Walmart. Now that Walmart said they will recognize those unions, let's see whether the unions can start to really represent workers and create services to represent those workers, which make people want to join unions. I mean, that's the key challenge now.
John Evans is Secretary General of the Trade Union Advisory Committee of the OECD, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. John, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. It's here and now. A study out today finds that Asian children continue to outrank their counterparts in the United States in math and science, as they did 4 years ago and 4 years before that. This is the third in a series of reports from Boston College called Trends in International Mathematics and Science Study, or TIMSS. It's a global comparison of grade schoolers' performance in math and science, the first of its kind to be conducted over such a long period of time. BC's International Study Center conducts the TIMSS research. The center's co-director, Dr. Ina Mullis, spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes.
The study you're releasing this morning is based on an assessment of data gathered last year from more than 360,000 students in fourth and eighth grades in 49 countries, which leads to my first question. Where do American grade schoolers rank in your research?
Well, American grade schoolers rank about medium to a little above medium, and which is, I suppose, not what the United States would really hope for, and they really have retained the same ranking or same level of performance as they had in 1995, 8 years ago.
Well, that sparks a couple of questions. First of all, if you would, what do you mean when you say they rank at medium or maybe a little above?
Well, we have what we call the TIMSS scale, and we have one for mathematics, and we have one for science, and our fourth grade students, our grade schoolers, are just a shade above 500 on those scales. So that's kind of medium.
How many nations are above us?
Well, the very highest performing countries are the Asian countries, and they're substantially ahead of us. So in terms of where we stand, we had a whole range of countries, you know, from underdeveloped countries to some developed countries. So the ranking, I guess, is kind of based, you know, on the number of participants we have. I think what is more interesting is to look at the difference in the quality of math that the top-performing Asian countries can do and the math that our students can do and the science that they can do versus the science we can do.
You're saying in many other nations, the kids are able to solve more sophisticated problems when it comes to math, and they simply know more when it comes to science?
Absolutely. So that, for example, if you would look at the eighth grade results in mathematics, where the difference is most is the largest. Where the largest difference is, you would see that 44% of the students in Singapore reached the advanced level, whereas only 7% did in the United States.
That should be rather troubling.
Yes, that is, I think, of a great deal of concern as we look to a future that in a global economy based on communication and technology, and we look at a potential for this country not to be able to do those jobs as effectively as students from other countries. So I know Alan Greenspan had mentioned in a speech that he had made, you know, that he found it of great concern, the outsourcing of, you know, the highly sophisticated jobs in the technology fields if we didn't improve our educational levels.
Can you inform us as to the reasons why you think what's happening in the U.S. is happening?
Well, I think that the mathematics and the in particular, and the science too to some extent, that student study in the United States is just not as challenging or as sophisticated as the mathematics that students are studying in these other
It's a curriculum problem. It's a curriculum
yes, first
problem?
First of all, a curriculum problem. And I think then secondly, we have a teaching force that it's a product of the same education system. And so their skills in advanced mathematics may be somewhat limited. And so you can't just introduce a new curriculum in complicated algebra and geometry without teachers who know complicated algebra and geometry. So it's next to teacher preparation problem or, you know, simultaneously a teacher preparation problem.
Beyond teacher preparation, what other changes, in your view, does the U.S. need to make in order to catch up and keep up with better-performing countries?
Well, I think that parents and society can do its part, too. I think that the United States might be one of the few countries in the world where it's socially acceptable, if sometimes not even desirable, to say that you're not good at mathematics. And that, you know, you're just not a numbers person.
Let me ask you, as a researcher, what do you make of the move by some school districts across America who have looked at the performance of other countries and who are adopting some of the curriculum that that other countries are using to educate their students? And I'm thinking specifically here of Massachusetts, where the state education commissioner was so impressed with the performance of the students in Singapore that he's decided to import math textbooks from there to use in some schools in Massachusetts.
Well, I think that whatever steps that you take to help improve the level of the mathematics that students are studying and the preparation of teachers to teach it is a good thing. And if looking at the materials, curriculum and instructional materials from Singapore can help in that direction, you know, that's a good thing, I think. I think there probably are other you know, materials, too, that would do that. But I think that, taking steps to make things better is a good thing.
But I seem to sense that what you're suggesting is that it's a long road.
Yes, I think it's a very long road. We've been working on reform in mathematics for, you know, I don't know, to be 15, maybe 20 years. I know the first NCTM guidelines came out in 1989. They were working on them before then. States all around the country have been working on developing math guidelines. People have been working hard, you know, for these 15 years or so. And so it's a good thing that we're seeing a little progress, but it's a very long road.
Dr. Ina Mullis is co-director of the International Study Center at Boston College's Lynch School of Education. She spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes. to come, we talk to children's book author Susan Goodman, who writes a lot about science for kids and wonders why others don't. You're listening to Here and Now. It's long been believed by many that stress contributes to disease. Well, a study out last month claimed to show the first direct link between stress and premature aging, prompting some to wonder, does it mean that if I have a stressful life, I'll also have a shorter one? Joining us now in the studio is Judy Foreman, health and science columnist. Her syndicated column appears in newspapers today. And Judy, you write about several studies on stress, but this most recent one, it seems very clear, and it seems to say that stressed out people die younger.
Not quite. But it is a really important study. It actually shows that very stressed people, women in particular in this study, have shorter telomeres, which are little things on the end of chromosomes, like the tip on a shoestring, a shoelace. They're supposed to stay long, and as long as they're long, that keeps the chromosomes healthy and the cell can divide normally. Once they start to shrivel up, as they do normally with aging, the cell eventually dies. So what they found with this study was that the most stressed people actually had shorter and shorter telomeres. It's a direct link between stress and something bad going on way inside a cell.
Well, and who are these people? Who was the control group?
Well, the people who were the most stressed were women who were caring for a sick child. The other people in the study were women who were not caring for a sick child. And all the women were healthy by themselves. It was only the children who were sick or not.
And so these women who are, you know, anyone who knows someone caring for a very sick child knows that that is incredibly stressful. And they were the women who had this chromosome damage.
That's right. And this is not just a sick kid with tonsillitis. This is a chronically ill child.
Right.
So it goes on for years and years, as long as 12 years in this study.
By the way, Judy, you said the women in the study were healthy, their children were sick, but do they start getting sick as well because of the stress?
No, they were all perfectly healthy. This was a sort of a subcellular change that was found, and it hasn't yet been linked to any specific health effects in the women.
Right. Well, were there differences in the women who were taking care of these very sick children?
Yes, they were, even though they were all kind of in more or less objectively the same situation, which was stressful, some of the women really felt this as very stressful subjectively, and some felt it as less stressful. And one of the interesting things that the researchers found was that that internal perception of, oh, my God, I am really stressed, is what's correlated with the most damage to these telomeres on the end of chromosomes.
As opposed to perhaps seeing it as a challenge.
Exactly.
Something that, you know, you've been handed.
In fact, there's two different kinds of stress that researchers talk about. Threat stress, where you really feel threatened and like your survival or your mental health is going to go down the tubes. Or challenge stress, people who just sort of see a situation as a challenge.
Mm.
But I don't think it's totally a matter of willpower to sort of redefine your situation that way.
Right. Well, now some people believe that stress causes everything from high blood pressure to cancer. You looked at some other studies. What is true?
Okay, that's a really good question. Stress does not cause cancer. I mean, that's even worth repeating. There have been a lot of studies that show that people who have been prisoners of war or been in concentration camps or other extremely objectively stressful situations don't get cancer any more than anybody else. So it seems that for some reason, cancer, so far at least, has not been linked with stress. But a lot of other things have, like heart disease, heart attacks in a big study that just came out a few months ago, insomnia, a lot of psychosomatic things that you could imagine, you know, like having worse hot flashes, having a lower threshold for pain, in other words, being more sensitive to pain, anxiety, depression, hostility, anger, all those things seem to get worse with stress.
You also write about another study, a 52-country study published in Lancet this year that found that stress raises the risk of heart attack 2.5 times as much as smoking.
Yes. You know, it gets to researchers, it gets kind of nuanced because you have to define exactly what kind of stress. In this study, they looked at financial stress, which is a biggie, stress at home, stress at work, and a couple of other kinds. But all of those were linked with heart attacks.
Well, I'm thinking about these otherwise healthy women who are taking care of these, you know, very sick children, and their chromosomes are being damaged, and I'm sure they are feeling, you know, this sense of aging. What should they do?
There are a lot of things that people can do, and it's sort of whatever works for you. Jogging, meditation, yoga, watching your tropical fish, whatever you can do to kind of make your mind almost like a blank for 20 minutes. And what seems to be the key is repetition. If you have a little mantra to yourself or just counting quietly for 20 minutes, That gets your mind off of the daily sort of ritualistic thinking that you're going through, and it gives your mind some peace.
And that can really make you healthier.
Yes, it can.
Judy Foreman, health and science columnist. For more on today's column on stress and aging, go to our website, here-now.org. Judy, as always, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. Robin Young, it's Here and Now with this sports note from here in Boston. Three-time Cy Young Award winner Pedro Martinez, who helped the Red Sox win the first World Series since 1918, is changing uniforms. But Sox fans can take heart, at least it won't be the Yankees' pinstripes. Pedro has signed a four-year, $52 million deal with the New York Mets. The Mets deal gave Martinez one more year of security and about $12 million more dollars than the Red Sox were willing to give. His departure leaves the World Series champs with a giant hole in their starting rotation, although they've recently signed veteran pitcher David Wells. The newspapers in New York are greeting the news of their former foe coming to town in their usual form. New York Yankees would chant, fans would chant, "Who's your daddy?" at Martinez. Now that he's gone to the other New York team, the Daily News headline taunts, "Who's your stepdaddy?" Yeah, well, whatever. Author Susan Goodman makes life an adventure. She's moonwalked at a space camp, paddled the Amazon, been to a buffalo roundup, and slept underwater. And she's written about all of it for kids. She's even taken up a subject near and dear to a young child's heart and humor, yes, poop. Two of Susan Goodman's latest children's books include On This Spot, a peeling back in time from one place, that being a New York City street corner. On This Spot just made the Washington Post best books for young readers in 2004. Susan also wrote Skyscraper, a look at how a 52-story building is constructed on a busy New York street. It's become the book list editor's choice for the year and has won BookLink's Lasting Connections Award. And author Susan Goodman joins us now in the studio. Welcome.
Hello, Robin.
I have in front of me The Truth About Poop, reminiscent of the Japanese classic Everyone Poops. What was your inspiration?
Well, actually, I was at a school doing a school visit, and I was talking to a bunch of kids about the Amazon, and I happened to bring up a sloth fact. And while I was talking about the sloths, I mentioned that sloths poop once a week. The kids giggled. We moved on. And afterwards, the principal came up to me and said, Mrs. Goodman, that was a wonderful presentation for the 10:30. Drop the sloth fact. And I have to say, there were two parts of me that reacted to this, Robin. And the first one, the adult, thought, isn't it strange that we have this taboo about an everyday, such an important thing that we do every day? And the six-year-old went, oh, yeah?
There's really good information in this book.
Thank you. And it's, in a lot of ways, a way that we were able to get them learning about science and history and biology without even knowing about it.
Right.
Because it's so much fun.
Well, science and what makes things work, that's a part of all your books. Skyscraper, the story of a 52-story building and how it gets built in the middle of New York City, whereas your other books are illustrated. This is photographs. And you went up to a skyscraper as it was being built. Why did you decide to do this?
Well, when we found out that this building was going up, photographer Mike Doolittle and I thought, wouldn't it be fabulous to be able to just spend the 3.5 years it takes for a skyscraper to be built, following the progress of it, and that's what we were able to do.
And, you know, it's interesting in light of 9/11, because I'm wondering if little kids now are looking at skyscrapers and wondering what holds them up and... did you have that in mind, or just is that a side effect?
Well, the book was actually sold, and groundbreaking happened long before 9/11. But 9/11 did have an impact on this book. There was no question. Well, for one thing, the building just construction stopped. Managers went to help triage. Our surveyors went to help people know whether or not buildings were safe to go into.
Well, it would seem like a very powerful antidote to 9/11, because kids can see this building go up.
Absolutely.
And it's just beautiful. I mean, the photographs of how it gets built and how it gets made and the facts. Who knew that water towers inside these huge buildings, 90-foot tanks that stretch across the buildings, one east to west, the other north to south, and move as the buildings move,
to keep them from swaying.
Keep it from swaying too much.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Okay. Well, that's Susan Goodman's Skyscraper. And now we want to move to another offering, because we do think that these are terrific, terrific books that you might want to consider for kids for the holidays. This one is called On This Spot, An Expedition Back Through Time. And you start in modern-day New York and move backwards?
Mm-hmm.
One spot in New York. Tell us what you do.
I picked a spot down near Wall Street, and I take that spot from today, all the way back in time, 540 million years until the beginning of life.
And it's a very thin book. It's amazing how you did that.
Well, we covered a lot of ground.
You did. Well, it goes from modern-day New York, where the city hums and hurries, and under its sidewalks is the subway. Turn to the next page. Wait a minute. 175 years ago, horse-drawn carriages, oil lanterns. We did note, though, that 175 years ago, it says, peddlers sell water because city wells didn't have enough for everyone, much like today.
Indeed.
But then as we go back through New Amsterdam, through the Indians, 15,000 years ago with the Arctic fox and the snowshoe hare.
The amazing thing is that New York is one of the few places in our country that underwent such dramatic transformations. I mean, there were mountains higher than the Himalayas. There was a tropical sea. There were dinosaurs. There were volcanoes. There were glaciers that were so thick that they would have buried the world's tallest buildings.
Mm. And at the back of the book, you have a timeline dating from today to 544 million years ago. Children love this kind of thing. It's like taking them back in time. It's beautifully illustrated. But I'm wondering, I don't feel I see very many science books. And we have actually talked on this program about how some science is controversial. For instance, this book doesn't mention God and who created the world. And I'm just wondering, is science a tough subject for a children's book author to sell to publishers?
I don't think it's a tough sell, but I think that nonfiction is under a bit of a crisis right now. I think you're right, Robin. Science at this time in our culture is a bit under siege. It's sad to me that we don't let some of the authors who have amazing voices and voices and visions sort of talk about science and let kids know the wonders of their world.
You said earlier that the six-year-old in you told you to do something. Do you have to retrieve different yous inside you when you write? How do you write for a child?
I mean, sometimes I think you do. For example, I'm just finishing up a book where I was lucky enough to go with the Air Force up to the Arctic Circle because the National Science Foundation does science there. And when I came back, I started writing this book, and I was getting bogged down by the facts and, you know, how cold it was and this and that and the other. And then finally one day I said, this is crazy. I'm writing a boring book about something that was a thrill. And I just went upstairs, turned off all the lights, opened my computer, looked at the screen and said, okay, what's cool? You know, just write everything that was wonderful, everything that was exciting, everything that was, like, awesome in the word, using the word awe. Mm-hmm. And at the end of that, I had the basis of my book. Mm. So is that my inner child? Who knows? I mean, it's maybe the six-year-old in all of us.
It's good advice for any writer.
Well, there you go.
Write with the word awe. What inspired awe? Susan Goodman, author of 24 children's books, including the award-winning Skyscraper and On This Spot. She lives in Boston, Massachusetts. Susan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And for more information on Susan Goodman's books, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again. Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next.